3. Outside influences, too, had come into play in the matter, however. Pyotr Stepanovich certainly had some designs on his parent. In my opinion, he calculated upon reducing the old man to despair, and so to driving him to some open scandal of a certain sort. This was to serve some remote and quite other object of his own, of which I shall speak hereafter. All sorts of plans and calculations of this kind were swarming in masses in his mind at that time, and almost all, of course, of a fantastic character. He had designs on another victim, besides Stepan Trofimovich. In fact, as appeared afterwards, his victims were not few in number, but this one he reckoned upon particularly, and it was Mr. von Lempke himself. Andrei Antonovich von Lempke belonged to that race so favoured by nature, which is reckoned by hundreds of thousands at the Russian census, and is perhaps unconscious that it forms throughout its whole mass a strictly organised union. And this union, of course, is not planned and premeditated, but exists spontaneously in the whole race, without words or agreements, as a moral obligation consisting in mutual support given by all members of the race to one another at all times and places and under all circumstances. Andrei Antonovich had the honour of being educated in one of those more exalted Russian educational institutions which are filled with the youth from families well provided with wealth or connections. Almost immediately on finishing their studies, the pupils were appointed to rather important posts in one of the government departments. Andrei Antonovich had one uncle, a colonel of engineers, and another a baker, but he managed to get into this aristocratic school and met many of his fellow countrymen in a similar position. He was a good-humoured companion, was rather stupid at his studies, but always popular. And when many of his companions in the upper forms, chiefly Russians, had already learned to discuss the loftiest modern questions and looked as though they were only waiting to leave school to settle the affairs of the universe, Andrei Antonovich was still absorbed in the most innocent schoolboy interests. He amused them all, it is true, by his pranks, which were of a very simple character, at the most a little coarse, but he made it his object to be funny. At one time he would blow his nose in a wonderful way when the professor addressed a question to him, thereby making his schoolfellows and the professor laugh. Another time, in the dormitory, he would act some indecent living picture to the general applause, or he would play the overture to Fra Diavolo with his nose rather skilfully. He was distinguished, too, by intentional untidiness, thinking this, for some reason, witty. In his very last year at school, he began writing Russian poetry. Of his native language, he had only an ungrammatical knowledge, like many of his race in Russia. This turn for versifying drew him to a gloomy and depressed schoolfellow, the son of a poor Russian general, who was considered in the school to be a great future light in literature. The latter patronized him. But it happened that 3 years after leaving school, this melancholy schoolfellow, who had flung up his official career for the sake of Russian literature, and was consequently going about in torn boots, with his teeth chattering with cold, wearing a light summer overcoat in the late autumn, met one day on the Anichin Bridge his former protégé, Lempke, as he always used to be called at school. And what do you suppose? He did not at first recognize him, and stood still in surprise. Before him stood an irreproachably dressed young man, with wonderfully well-kept whiskers of a reddish hue, with pince-nez, with patent leather boots, and the freshest of gloves, in a full overcoat from Sharma's, and with a portfolio under his arm. Lempke was cordial to his old schoolfellow, gave him his address, and begged him to come and see him some evening. It appeared, too, that he was by now not Lempke, but von Lempke. The schoolfellow came to see him, however, simply from malice, perhaps. On the staircase, which was covered with red felt and was rather ugly and by no means smart, he was met and questioned by the house porter. A bell rang loudly upstairs, but instead of the wealth which the visitor expected, he found Lempke in a very little side room, which had a dark and dilapidated appearance, partitioned into two by a large dark green curtain, and furnished with very old though comfortable furniture, with dark green blinds on high narrow windows. Von Lempke lodged in the house of a very distant relation, a general who was his patron. He met his visitor cordially, was serious and exquisitely polite. They talked of literature, too, but kept within the bounds of decorum. A manservant in a white tie brought them some weak tea and little dry round biscuits. The schoolfellow, from spite, asked for some seltzer water. It was given him, but after some delays, and Lempke was somewhat embarrassed at having to summon the footman a second time and give him orders. But of himself, he asked his visitor whether he would like some supper, and was obviously relieved when he refused and went away. In short, Lempke was making his career, and was living in dependence on his fellow countryman, the influential general. He was at that time sighing for the general's fifth daughter, and it seemed to him that his feeling was reciprocated, but Amalia was nonetheless married in due time to an elderly factory owner, a German, and an old comrade of the general's. Andrei Antonovitch did not shed many tears, but made a paper theatre. The curtain drew up, the actors came in and gesticulated with their arms. There were spectators in the boxes. The orchestra moved their bows across their fiddles by machinery. The conductor waved his baton, and in the stalls, officers and dandies clapped their hands. It was all made of cardboard. It was all thought out and executed by Lempke himself. He spent 6 months over this theatre. The general arranged a friendly party on purpose. The theatre was exhibited. All the general's five daughters, including the newly married Amalia with her factory owner, numerous fraus and fräuleins with their menfolk, attentively examined and admired the theatre, after which they danced. Lempke was much gratified and was quickly consoled. The years passed by, and his career was secured. He always obtained good posts, and always under chiefs of his own race, and he worked his way up at last to a very fine position for a man of his age. He had for a long time been wishing to marry and looking about him carefully. Without the knowledge of his superiors, he had sent a novel to the editor of a magazine, but it had not been accepted. On the other hand, he cut out a complete toy railway, and again his creation was most successful. Passengers came onto the platform with bags and portmanteau, with dogs and children, and got into the carriages. The guards and porters moved away, the bell was rung, the signal was given, and the train started off. He was a whole year busy over this clever contrivance, but he had to get married all the same. The circle of his acquaintance was fairly wide, chiefly in the world of his compatriots, but his duties brought him into Russian spheres also, of course. Finally, when he was in his 39th year, he came in for a legacy. His uncle, the baker, died and left him 13,000 rubles in his will. The one thing needful was a suitable post. In spite of the rather elevated style of his surroundings in the service, Mr. von Lempke was a very modest man. He would have been perfectly satisfied with some independent little government post, with the right to as much government timber as he liked, or something snug of that sort, and he would have been content all his life long. But now, instead of the Minna or Ernestina he had expected, Yulia Mikhailovna suddenly appeared on the scene. His career was instantly raised to a more elevated plane. The modest and precise man felt that he, too, was capable of ambition. Yulia Mikhailovna had a fortune of 200 serfs, to reckon in the old style, and she had, besides, powerful friends. On the other hand, Lempke was handsome, and she was already over 40. It is remarkable that he fell genuinely in love with her by degrees as he became more used to being betrothed to her. On the morning of his wedding day, he sent her a poem. She liked all this very much, even the poem. It's no joke to be 40. He was very quickly raised to a certain grade and received a certain order of distinction, and then was appointed governor of our province. Before coming to us, Yulia Mikhailovna worked hard at moulding her husband. In her opinion, he was not without abilities. He knew how to make an entrance and to appear to advantage. He understood how to listen and be silent with profundity, had acquired a quite distinguished deportment, could make a speech, indeed had even some odds and ends of thought, and had caught the necessary gloss of modern liberalism. What worried her, however, was that he was not very open to new ideas, and after the long, everlasting plodding for a career, was unmistakably beginning to feel the need of repose. She tried to infect him with her own ambition, and he suddenly began making a toy church. The pastor came out to preach the sermon. The congregation listened with their hands before them. One lady was drying her tears with her handkerchief. One old gentleman was blowing his nose. Finally, the organ pealed forth. It had been ordered from Switzerland and made expressly in spite of all expense. Yulia Mikhailovna, in positive alarm, carried off the whole structure as soon as she knew about it and locked it up in a box in her own room. To make up for it, she allowed him to write a novel on condition of its being kept secret. From that time, she began to reckon only upon herself. Unhappily, there was a good deal of shallowness and lack of judgment in her attitude. Destiny had kept her too long an old maid. Now, one idea after another fluttered through her ambitious and rather overexcited brain. She cherished designs. She positively desired to rule the province, dreamed of becoming at once the centre of a circle, adopted political sympathies. Von Lempke was actually a little alarmed, though, with his official tact. He quickly divined that he had no need at all to be uneasy about the government of the province itself. The first 2 or 3 months passed indeed very satisfactorily. But now Pyotr Stepanovich had turned up, and something queer began to happen. The fact was that young Verhovinsky, from the first step, had displayed a flagrant lack of respect for Andrei Antonovich, and had assumed a strange right to dictate to him, while Yulia Mikhailovna, who had always till then been so jealous of her husband's dignity, absolutely refused to notice it, or at any rate attached no consequence to it. The young man became a favourite, ate, drank, and almost slept in the house. Von Lempke tried to defend himself, called him young man before other people, and slapped him patronizingly on the shoulder, but made no impression. Pyotr Stepanovich always seemed to be laughing in his face, even when he appeared on the surface to be talking seriously to him, and he would say the most startling things to him before company. Returning home one day, he found the young man had installed himself in his study and was asleep on the sofa there, uninvited. He explained that he had come in and, finding no one at home, had had a good sleep. Von Lempke was offended and again complained to his wife. Laughing at his irritability, she observed tartly that he evidently did not know how to keep up his own dignity, and that with her anyway, the boy had never permitted himself any undue familiarity. He was naive and fresh indeed, though not regardful of the conventions of society. Von Lempke sulked. This time she made peace between them. Pyotr Stepanovich did not go so far as to apologize, but got out of it with a coarse jest, which might at another time have been taken for a fresh offence, but was accepted on this occasion as a token of repentance. The weak spot in Andrei Antonovich's position was that he had blundered in the first instance by divulging the secret of his novel to him, imagining him to be an ardent young man of poetic feeling, and having long dreamed of securing a listener, he had, during the early days of their acquaintance, on one occasion read aloud 2 chapters to him. The young man had listened without disguising his boredom, had rudely yawned, had vouchsafed no word of praise, but on leaving had asked for the manuscript that he might form an opinion of it at his leisure, and Andrei Antonovitch had given it him. He had not returned the manuscript since, though he dropped in every day and had turned off all inquiries with a laugh. Afterwards, he declared that he had lost it in the street. At the time, Yulia Mikhailovna was terribly angry with her husband when she heard of it. "Perhaps you told him about the church, too," she burst out, almost in dismay. Von Limpke unmistakably began to brood, and brooding was bad for him and had been forbidden by the doctors. Apart from the fact that there were signs of trouble in the province, of which we will speak later, he had private reasons for brooding. His heart was wounded, not merely his official dignity. When Andrei Antonovitch had entered upon married life, he had never conceived the possibility of conjugal strife or dissension in the future. It was inconsistent with the dreams he had cherished all his life of his Minna or Ernestina. He felt that he was unequal to enduring domestic storms. Yulia Mikhailovna had an open explanation with him at last. "You can't be angry at this," she said, "if only because you've still as much sense as he has, and are immeasurably higher in the social scale. The boy still preserves many traces of his old free-thinking habits. I believe it's simply mischief, but one can do nothing suddenly in a hurry. You must do things by degrees. We must make much of our young people. I treat them with affection and hold them back from the brink." "But he says such dreadful things," von Lebke objected. "I can't behave tolerantly when he maintains in my presence and before other people that the government purposely drenches the people with vodka in order to brutalize them and so keep them from revolution. Fancy my position when I'm forced to listen to that before everyone." As he said this, von Lebke recalled a conversation he had recently had with Pyotr Stepanovich. With the innocent object of displaying his liberal tendencies, he had shown him his own private collection of every possible kind of manifesto, Russian and foreign, which he had carefully collected since the year 1859, not simply from a love of collecting, but from a laudable interest in them. Pyotr Stepanovich, seeing his object, expressed the opinion that there was more sense in one line of some manifestos than in a whole government department. "Not even excluding yours, maybe." Lempke winced. "But this is premature among us. Premature," he pronounced, almost imploringly, pointing to the manifestos. "No, it is not premature. You see, you're afraid, so it's not premature. But here, for instance, is an incitement to destroy churches." "And why not? You're a sensible man, and of course you don't believe in it yourself, but you know perfectly well that you need religion to brutalize the people. Truth is honester than falsehood." I agree, I quite agree with you. But it is premature in this country," said von Lempke, frowning. "And how can you be an official of the government after that when you agree to demolishing churches and marching on Petersburg armed with staves and make it all simply a question of date?" Lempke was greatly put out at being so crudely caught. "It's not so, not so at all," he cried, carried away and more mortified in his amour propre. "You're young, you know nothing of our aims, and that's why you're mistaken. You see, my dear Pyotr Stepanovich, you call us officials of the government, don't you? Independent officials, don't you? But let me ask you, how are we acting? Ours is the responsibility, but in the long run, we serve the cause of progress, just as you do. We only hold together what you are unsettling, and what, but for us, would go to pieces in all directions. We are not your enemies, not a bit of it. We say to you, go forward, progress. You may even unsettle things, that is, things that are antiquated and in need of reform. But we will keep you, when need be, within necessary limits, and so save you from yourselves, for without us you would set Russia tottering, robbing her of all external decency, while our task is to preserve external decency. Understand that we are mutually essential to one another. In England, the Whigs and Tories are in the same way mutually essential to one another. Well, you're Whigs and we're Tories. That's how I look at it." Andrei Antonovitch rose to positive eloquence. He had been fond of talking in a liberal and intellectual style even in Petersburg, and the great thing here was that there was no one to play the spy on him. Pyotr Stepanovitch was silent and maintained an unusually grave air. This excited the orator more than ever. "Do you know that I, the person responsible for the province," he went on, walking about the study, "do you know, I have so many duties I can't perform one of them, and, on the other hand, I can say just as truly that there's nothing for me to do here. The whole secret of it is that everything depends upon the views of the government. Suppose the government were ever to found a republic from policy, or to pacify public excitement, and at the same time to increase the power of the governors, then we governors would swallow up the republic, and not the republic only. Anything you like we'll swallow up. I, at least, feel that I am ready. In one word, if the government dictates to me by telegram activité dévorante, I'll supply activité dévorante. I've told them here, straight in their faces, 'Dear sirs, to maintain the equilibrium and to develop all the provincial institutions, one thing is essential, the increase of the power of the governor. You see, it's necessary that all these institutions, the zemstvas, the law courts, should have a twofold existence. That is, on the one hand, it's necessary they should exist. I agree that it is necessary. On the other hand, it's necessary that they shouldn't. It's all according to the views of the government. If the mood takes them so that institutions seem suddenly necessary, I shall have them at once in readiness. The necessity passes, and no one will find them under my rule. That's what I understand by activité dévorante, and you can't have it without an increase of the governor's power. We are talking tête-à-tête. You know, I've already laid before the government in Petersburg the necessity of a special sentinel before the governor's house. I am awaiting an answer." "You ought to have two," Pyotr Stepanovitch commented. "Why two?" said von Lempke, stopping short before him. "One's not enough to create respect for you. You certainly ought to have two." Andrei Antonovitch made a wry face. "You! There's no limit to the liberties you take, Pyotr Stepanovitch. You take advantage of my good nature. You say cutting things and play the part of a bourreau bienfaisant." "Well, that's as you please," muttered Pyotr Stepanovitch. "Anyway, you pave the way for us and prepare for our success." "Now who are we, and what success?" said von Lempke, staring at him in surprise. But he got no answer. Yulia Mikhailovna, receiving a report of the conversation, was greatly displeased. "But I can't exercise my official authority upon your favourite," Andrei Antonovitch protested in self-defence, "especially when we're tête-à-tête. I may say too much in the goodness of my heart." "From too much goodness of heart. I didn't know you'd got a collection of manifestos. Be so good as to show them to me." "But he asked to have them for one day." "And you've let him have them again," cried Yulia Mikhailovna, getting angry. "How tactless." "I'll send someone to him at once to get them." "He won't give them up." "I'll insist on it," cried von Lempke, boiling over, and he jumped up from his seat. "Who's he that we should be so afraid of him, and who am I that I shouldn't dare to do anything?" "Sit down and calm yourself," said Yulia Mikhailovna, checking him. "I will answer your first question. He came to me with the highest recommendations. He's talented, and sometimes says extremely clever things. Karamazinov tells me that he has connections almost everywhere, and extraordinary influence over the younger generation in Petersburg and Moscow. And if through him I can attract them all and group them round myself, I shall be saving them from perdition by guiding them into a new outlet for their ambitions. He's devoted to me with his whole heart, and is guided by me in everything. But while they're being petted, the devil knows what they may not do. Of course, it's an idea, said von Lempke, vaguely defending himself. But here I've heard that manifestos of some sort have been found in X district. But there was a rumor of that in the summer. Manifestos, false banknotes, and all the rest of it. But they haven't found one of them so far. Who told you? I heard it from von Blum. Ah, don't talk to me of your Blum. Don't ever dare mention him again. Yulia Mikhailovna flew into a rage, and for a moment could not speak. Von Blum was a clerk in the governor's office whom she particularly hated. Of that later. Please, don't worry yourself about Verhovinsky, she said in conclusion. If he had taken part in any mischief, he wouldn't talk as he does to you and everyone else here. Talkers are not dangerous, and I will even go so far as to say that if anything were to happen, I should be the first to hear of it through him. He's quite fanatically devoted to me. I will observe, anticipating events, that, had it not been for Yulia Mikhailovna's obstinacy and self-conceit, probably nothing of all the mischief these wretched people succeeded in bringing about amongst us would have happened. She was responsible for a great deal.